Hello, and a very warm welcome to our Burgess Salmon webinar, Brexit, 1 month to go, focusing on the food and drink sector. I'm Rachel Moran, a partner in the banking team, and part of my practice focuses on food and drink business financings. I act for both lenders and corporate clients, from food manufacturers to retail and hospitality. I'm delighted to be introducing this webinar, which will provide a recap of some of the pressing issues that food and drink businesses need to focus on to be ready for the end of the transition period. The first half of the webinar will focus on regulatory changes impacting the industry, and the second half considers commercial contracts, employees, and trade. I will now invite our first two speakers to switch on their cameras. Sian Edmonds heads our food and drink team. She specializes in dispute resolution with a focus on food, drink, and agriculture, and on food regulation. Simon Tilling is head of our environmental law team. He's a graduate chemist turned lawyer and has developed a particular expertise in the regulatory control of chemicals and materials to protect human health and environment. They will be talking about regulatory issues arising out of Brexit and, given the increased public awareness of the environmental impact of packaging, special focus will be given to packaging of food and drink. Thank you both.
Thank you, Rachel. So, Sian, you and I are going to be talking about regulations. And so before getting into the details, let's just remind ourselves of the basics. What is the UK leaving at the end of this year? Well, it's leaving an EU single market and customs union, and with, of course, the four freedoms, the freedom of movement of goods, services, people and capital. And to allow that free movement, we've had this common rule book where the standards are set across the single market, and that's the regulations that you and I are going to be talking about. So from the 1st of January 2021, the crucial thing is that we have two independent markets, the single market of the EU and the Great British market. And there will be inevitable consequences, even if the standards remain the same, about having two physically different markets. And then, of course, we've also got the question of divergence of the standards themselves. So from a regulatory perspective, what I want to explore with you, Sian, is that what is going to change immediately and we need to look out for from 1st of January, and what we might also need to watch out for in time. So let's just start with a quick point of clarification. Do we start with the same rules on food safety on day one?
Yes, as far as food safety is concerned, the rules aren't going to change in the short to medium term, certainly. I mean, who knows what will happen long term, but there's a commitment to staying with the same set of rules as far as safety and welfare go.
Great. Well, that's something to start with, at least. And we're talking about two markets, but we're talking about a Great Britain market. So what's going on and what's happening with Northern Ireland?
Well, it gets a little bit complicated, I'm afraid. So the Northern Irish Protocol has basically established that the UK government has agreed that it will maintain the position that's existed since the Good Friday Agreement was implemented, thereby ensuring that there's no hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. What that means in practice is that Northern Ireland is actually going to remain in the single market for goods with the rest of the EU. So in practice, despite what the government has said, there is effectively going to be a hard border across the Irish Sea with free movement of goods between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland complying with EU regulations as far as labelling as well as safety issues go, which means for food businesses, the standards remain in Northern Ireland the same as the rest of the EU, which makes things complicated because you essentially have two different markets. You have a GB market and you have a Northern Ireland / EU market.
Can you just talk us through the changes to food and drink labels from 1st of January and what's going to happen there?
Yes, well, at a very basic level, the existing arrangement where you need to have an address of the food business operator on your food packaging labels is going to change. So from the 1st of January 2021, anyone exporting goods from GB to Northern Ireland or to the EU must have an EU or Northern Irish address of a food business operator or a friendly food business importer. And any goods that are coming from the GB market will have to have a label that includes an EU address, basically. As far as goods that are coming into GB from the EU or Northern Ireland, longer term, the plan is that equally you will have to have a GB address. So anyone bringing goods in from either Belfast or from Paris or anywhere else in the EU will have to have an equivalent arrangement where they have a GB address or they have a friendly importer address based in the GB market. The government has realised that food businesses just really aren't ready as a collective to implement this. So what they've said is that they are happy to extend the period of time for that labelling arrangement to come in to the 30th of September 2022. So actually GB businesses, or indeed any businesses, have quite a long period of time to get their ducks in a row when it comes to labelling for the GB market. But the current arrangement, unless something miraculous happens between now and the 1st of January, the arrangement is that anything going outside of the GB market will have to have an appropriate address put on it.
Right. Thank you, Sian. And you've touched upon there people not being ready. And it's a conversation that I'm having with clients about various products. We can't get ready in time. What is the enforcement arrangements going to be? So what are you hearing about enforcement?
Well, the UK government has said that they're going to adopt a proportionate approach to enforcement, whatever that means in practice. I think it means they won't go in heavy handed. And it may be that approach will extend to the Northern Irish market as well. But of course, we don't have control over over what happens in the wider EU. And certainly in certain jurisdictions within the EU, the situation can be quite difficult for food businesses. Places like Germany, for example, what are effectively private prosecutions can be brought and often are by consumer interest groups. It may be the case that we'll see some of that starting to crop up if there are labels in the EU market that aren't compliant. And certainly, I think that, you know, you have to question why the European Union as a collective would allow GB to have its cake and eat it when it comes to non-compliance.
Yes, indeed. OK, were that things like health and identity marks?
Yeah, so these are the little sort of oval logos that you see on certain products. They have to be applied to products of animal origin, and they basically state place of origin of the product and the approval number of the food premises where the product's been produced. So this covers things like meat, fish, egg products, cheese, milk, and other dairy products, and demonstrate that they're fit for human consumption. So from the 1st of January, new logos have to be applied to UK products going into the EU. But again, the issue's more complicated because there are different marks depending on whether your products have been produced in the GB market or the Northern Irish market. And once again, we've got this sort of disparity between the dates of enforcement. So the baseline for products going into the EU market is that the new logos have to be applied from the 1st of January 2021. But the UK government has again extended the deadline for products coming into the GB market to 30 September 2022. So again, a bit more time to become compliant.
OK, were that things like country of origin labelling?
Yeah, so this is the rules vary according to whether your product fits within the sort of compulsion area or the voluntary area. So there are certain products that have to have a country of origin label on them. That includes products like meat, fish, eggs, seafood, honey, and so on. And if you're selling to the final consumer or to mass caterers, you have to say what country they've derived from. But there are also rules around not misleading consumers. So there's what's more of essentially a voluntary system for where you've used country of origin as a sort of marketing tool. So you've said, you know, best of British or whatever. You have to make sure that that's not a misleading statement. So if actually you've got a pie that was made in the GB market, but uses products from all over the place, you'd have to say so on your labels. And some new rules came in earlier this year, which said that you also have to include the country of origin if your primary ingredient it differs from the one that's either indicated or implied on your label. So again, if you have a best of British pie, but actually the primary ingredient is flour, and that flour has come from France, for example, you'd have to say so. And this is relevant for the Brexit changes, because at the moment you can just simply say your products derived from the EU. But going forwards from the 1st of January, if actually the products are from the GB market, you'd have to say that if it's going into the EU market, you'd have to say that it was non-EU product. And again, arrangements will be changing for products that are coming into GB. So the GB EU issue applies again.
Great, thanks, Sian. And organic products, I've been picking up in the press conversations about organic standards. What's going on there?
Yes, well, at the moment, there's no agreement on equivalency of organic standards going forward. So food business operators who are exporting organic products from the GB market into the EU market can no longer use the EU organic labelling regime. So unless we get a deal between now and the 1st of January, any GB product going into the EU market won't be able to say that it's an organic product. They can still export the product, and as long as it complies with all the other regulations, that's fine. But they can't say it's an organic product. For the GB market, the UK government has said that they will recognise EU equivalency until the 31st of December 2021. So anything coming in can use the EU organic logo, and that will be fine. There will be no problem with that.
OK, but that's a different date, isn't it? 31st of December 2021 to our September 2022 dates. Why is there divergence of dates for labelling?
These rules were agreed in advance of the 30 September 2022 change, which was brought in quite recently, I think in response to the fact that lots of food businesses were saying, help, we're just not ready. A combination of uncertainty about what was happening with Brexit and, of course, the dreaded coronavirus has meant that businesses have been in crisis management mode a lot of the time this year, really.
Sure. And what about the specialist registers that I know exist for things like geographical indications? What's going to happen with these?
Yeah, so there's a raft of regimes, geographical indicators being one of them. These in particular are the products which have protected status because of they're a particular type of product. Things like Cornish pasties, Stilton cheese, Cornish clotted cream, and so on. And at the moment, there's a central register of these protected designations within the EU. But from the 1st of January, there will be two regimes. So the EU and UK have agreed that they will continue to honour those existing registrations. But going forward, there will be two separate registers run, one for the UK, one for the EU. And any new product that registration is sought will have to apply to the two registers separately. So you could have a regime where you've got one product protected in the GB market, but not in the EU market, or vice versa. In terms of the labelling that goes with us, GB producers have until the 1st of January 2024, so a different date again, to change their packaging and materials. But as I say, any new products will have to grapple with the two registers. So again, changes afoot. So then we've got other registers like the Health and Nutrition Claims Register. So these are the a mix of, you've got sort of mandatory back of pack labelling requirements, which are going to stay the same, at least in the short term. And then you've got a list, an EU list of authorised health claims that you can make voluntarily in relation to your products. So it could be, you know, magnesium reduces fatigue, that sort of thing. Going forwards from the 1st of January 2021, again, there will be two separate registers that will be running. So anything that's already been approved, you're fine to use in both markets. But new approvals will have to go through two separate application systems. The UK has said that it will continue to apply the guidance and criteria that have been used up until now as part of the EU regime. So in theory, two different groups of two different committees applying the same sets of rules. But of course, there's never an exact answer to some of these things. And it may be that you'll end up with different answers from those two committees, which could mean that you can use certain claims in one market but not the other, which again adds complexity to the whole labelling regime for food businesses that are trading across borders. And then we've got other registers like the novel food register. So that's looking at things like insects or whatever. And again, same system applies, two registers going forwards, potentially two different outcomes from two different assessment committees. So yes, changes on the horizon as well as from the 1st of January, I'm afraid. But I know that you've been looking at the packaging side of things. That's what you do. What's happening on the packaging front?
It's a very similar story, I think, to the one that you've been talking about, Sian. On day one, the standards we have for packaging are going to be the same, so that's the way to create the least disruption to business. So if your product is packaged in something that's legitimate for the market right now, it'll be legitimate for both the EU single market and the GB market on the 1st of January 2021. But I think this is one where we need to look to the future, because there's a huge amount of interest in the packaging agenda. We've had the Blue Planet 2 effect, which is and the war on plastics. But there's also climate change worries and concerns about food waste and longevity to produce and the importance of packaging, as well as the weight of packaging. So we're having a lot of signposting from politicians that there's going to be some significant changes coming. And I think we're going to see this being an area where we might get divergence quite quickly between different judgments being made in the GB market to the EU market as this agenda is really grappled with.
Right. And is that going to be a similar situation for food contact materials? How will that all work in practice?
Yeah, I think food contact materials may be one of the first areas where we see a degree of divergence from the start. Right now, we have a general obligation on food contact materials that they must be made with good manufacturing practice, and under normal and foreseeable conditions, food contact material substances shouldn't be transferred onto the food in any level that could endanger human health. So they're the common standards. I can't see them changing. But we have a series of harmonised measures, which are decisions taken by the Commission to date on things like plastics and ceramics. So this is something where, just as you were saying, we could have two decision makers in the GB market and the single market looking at the same evidence base and quite quickly reaching quite different decisions based on it. And we know that this is coming under scrutiny, because this year we've had the EU's chemical strategy for sustainability, which is looking at substances and how they get into human health and human exposure. And we've had the EU's farm to fork strategy from earlier in the year, which also said it would take a closer look at food contact materials. So we know this is on the public policy agenda for the EU. And then we wait to see what the UK position will be.
Right. Okay. So, for the newly independent UK, what else is on the horizon?
Well, the UK has been making quite a lot of noise about the plastics agenda in particular, and we've got a number of legislative movements already. So, in the UK, we're looking to extend producer responsibility, and that's making the full costs of recycling packaging, including the costs of littering, to be pushed right back up the chain to the producers and those who put the products on the market. So big changes there. We're looking at a plastic packaging tax from 2022 to encourage use of recycled materials. We're going to have deposit return schemes for certain packaging items, plastic bottles, for example. Now, that's a good example where even in the GB market, we're going to see some devolution issues, because waste and recycling is a devolved matter. So Scotland actually is leading the way on the deposit return schemes, and we're going to have different, or we are likely to have different regimes in the different devolved administrations. So it's and again, single use bans are going to be something that Scotland and Wales may want to do different to England. So there's a lot of issues there that are coming through.
Yeah, lots for food businesses to grapple with. Well, thanks, Simon. I think we're just about finished on our chat. I'll hand back to Rachel.
Thank you.
Sian and Simon, many thanks for those insights. We'll now be joined for the second half of the webinar by Helen Scott-Lawler and Hugh Cook. Helen heads our commercial group and is going to talk about your contracts and how they may need to change because of Brexit, touch on trade, and also look at intellectual property rights. Hugh is a senior lawyer in our employment and business immigration team. He's going to talk about how the immigration regime is changing, its impact on businesses, particularly those who employ European nationals. I'll hand over to Hugh and Helen.
Thanks, Rachel. Helen, can I kick off with the big question, which is, are we going to get huge queues of lorries at the ports from the 1st of January?
Well, I think we all hope not, but trials they've been running in Kent suggest that is certainly a very real possibility. And I'm conscious that many people on this webinar may well have a better picture than we do, perhaps because of working with trade bodies or having direct conversations with government. But what is very clear is that we are going to have increased checks at our ports for all goods coming from and going into the EU. Sian has touched on some of the regulatory reasons for that. And we know that businesses are expected to be prepared to have an EORI number, and that their logistics suppliers need to turn up at ports with all of the right paperwork or risk simply being turned away. And the last couple of weeks, and probably even a bit longer, has seen a lot of stories about the software to facilitate this being behind, both in the UK and in the EU, and probably not even being up and running until as far away as 2022. But personally, ever the optimist, it seems to me that even if there is an initial hiccup, it seems likely that practical workarounds will be put in place, even if they are slightly suboptimal in the shorter term.
Okay. So ports are likely to be an issue. What about the tariff position for goods going in and out of the UK? What do we know about that?
Well, now that we don't know. Negotiations with the EU are still ongoing. And press speculation at the moment is all fairly negative. But I think most commentators are very much hoping that they reach a positive outcome, a free trade deal, such that we could be looking at a tariff-free position on most goods traded with the EU. If that doesn't happen, then yes, from the 1st of January, there will be tariffs on most goods going in and out of the EU. Some of those tariffs are zero rated, so it's not necessarily a complete change for everything, but nonetheless, there will be a tariff position in that time. There is a very long list of UK and EU tariffs, so each product would need to be separately considered. But the other point to bear in mind is, of course, that by leaving the EU, we also fall out of the trade deals that the EU has elsewhere in the world.
And does that mean that we're going to see tariffs for non-EU imports and exports?
Absolutely. But we do already. UK government has been working to get agreements with a good number of countries, for example, South Africa, Switzerland, Norway and Iceland. And just a couple of weeks ago, it was announced that Canada had agreed to roll over the existing trading relationship, which is currently worth about $20 billion a year. And the deal, which was announced with Japan just in October, was heralded as the very first that went simply beyond rolling over the same deal that we already have as part of the EU. The big hole is obviously the US, where we don't have a trade deal, but then neither does the EU, despite pre-Trump negotiations. So we're not tied to the EU in order to get a deal, but obviously we do offer a much smaller market than the EU does. Now, of course, a new president is very relevant here. And even aside from all of the other disincentives to do so, I think we probably messed with the Good Friday Agreement and the Northern Ireland border at our peril.
Indeed. I mean, I suppose that begs the question, what is the position with Northern Ireland?
Well, as Sian has said, under the Northern Ireland Protocol, the border between the UK and the EU has effectively been moved out into the middle of the Irish Sea. So checks will need to be conducted as if Northern Ireland were part of the EU rather than part of the UK. The tariff position will obviously depend on an EU deal. But if tariffs are payable on goods going into the EU, then the principle is that goods that enter Northern Ireland, which are at risk of being exported into the EU, may well have those tariffs levied, but that will then be refundable if the goods remain in Northern Ireland. For mainland businesses that send goods to Northern Ireland but don't export into the EU, that is going to add a lot of administrative burden, and there is a risk that some will just stop supplying Northern Ireland altogether.
Okay, so tariffs are an unknown, ports a bit of an unknown. What can businesses be certain about and actually control?
Well, there is certainly some clarity on the paperwork that will be needed, EORI numbers and that sort of thing. And people have now had 4.5 years since the Brexit vote to get their supply chain contracts in better shape to be ready for it. Although I appreciate that the last 9 months may have had one or two other slightly out of the blue distractions.
I think that's probably fair to say. On the issue of supply chain contracts, is there a risk that Brexit is going to mean that on the 1st of January they're going to be void or unenforceable?
Well, that was certainly something that people were very concerned about initially. that contracts might automatically terminate or change because of Brexit, possibly because Brexit frustrates the contract and makes it impossible to perform, or that Brexit is itself an event of force majeure, something outside the party's control and an act of God. But the general view is that both of these are unlikely, and that contracts will probably continue unamended through Brexit. And the fact that people have had over 4 years since the Brexit vote to deal with their contracts and make sure they can work in a post-Brexit world, and probably entered into a lot of supply contracts in that 4.5 year period, means it's even less likely frustrated contract or be force majeure.
Okay, okay. And what sort of changes have you seen your client make?
Well, at the most extreme, I have to say, a client was on the receiving end of this. I've seen attempts simply to pass all the way down the supply chain all of the risks of Brexit, to contractually oblige a supplier to make sure that Brexit makes no difference at all to the customer. Personally, I'm dubious about the practical effectiveness of that. It might give you someone to sue, but what use is that if you've put so much pressure on your supplier that they've gone under? In my view, it's better to look at the whole picture and see where you're most at risk and where those risks most need to be mitigated, and have each party take steps which are proportionate to their role in the supply chain.
Okay, okay. And that's useful. So in terms of the steps that businesses should be thinking about, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm conscious of timing, that we've been talking about this for some time now. So businesses will already have done a lot of this thinking. So apologies if there's nothing new here, in which case probably think of this as a last minute check or a comfort, as Tess Daly always says at the end of every Strictly Dance Off, you can do no more. But for the last couple of years, I've been advising people to think about where the risk spots are in their supply chains. And the higher risk areas are going to be key or business critical supplies, high value, high volume suppliers, single source supply arrangements where there's less resilience, or suppliers perhaps who themselves lack resilience. Perhaps they were already underperforming, and certainly the last 9 months may well not have helped that, for whom insolvency may be an issue if tariffs and exchange rates risks fall entirely to them. That will help you identify a heap of which contracts then need to be carefully looked at.
Okay, and once you've got that heat map, what should you do?
Well, once you've got that heat map of enhanced risks, you can then turn to look at the contracts themselves. And there are obvious things in contracts that are likely to change as a result of Brexit. Examples are simple amendments to the definition of the EU, or the way that certain legislation is referenced. But there could be issues in the drafting that go to the very core of the contract. Such if you are a distributor entitled to distribute in a territory described as the EU, then on Brexit, you may well lose your right to distribute in the UK unless you expressly introduce an amendment. Similarly, from a compliance perspective, perhaps your contract says that your supplier must comply with particular EU legislation on products that you're going to be selling in the UK. So you need that supplier to comply with the relevant UK legislation on it as well.
Okay. So like all good lawyers, we're saying make sure you look at what your contract says.
Absolutely. Sorry to be predictable, but yes, that is the first call. Look to see if it covers off the additional risks appropriately. And if the effects of Brexit mean that the contract is no longer entirely suitable, then options for renegotiation of key terms or even, you know, as a last point, termination could be considered. So people are looking at building in specific clauses to add flexibility to contracts to deal with particular consequences of Brexit. In thinking about that, there may be a number of Brexit-related trigger events that you might be trying to cover. So that might be material regulatory divergence by the UK, introduction of certain tariffs or tariffs beyond a specified range, or even currency fluctuations beyond specified limits. And if these happen, there could be different outcomes that you specify, requiring the parties to renegotiate the terms or giving the affected party a right to terminate. The parties may also put a level of materiality on those adverse impacts before either party is entitled to change or terminate. So whilst these Brexit clauses are, of course, being seen, caution is still needed. Normal drafting principles will apply. So the clause must be sufficiently clear so as to give certainty as to whether the triggering event has occurred and the material adverse impact has actually happened.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Well, I mean, that's been really helpful. Let's change tack slightly, because I know you're an intellectual property expert too. What's going to happen to people's IP registrations?
Well, most types of IP registration are territorial rather than EU-wide, so won't be affected by Brexit at all. So if you have UK trademarks or French trademarks or German patents or US patents, all of those will still continue unchanged. If you have a European patent, then actually that was also always going to lead to a bundle of national rights in each territory and was never limited to EU member states only. So all of that will actually be unaffected. Now, one exception to that is that for the last 25 years, there has been EU-wide trademark protection, an EU trademark, and more recently, EU-wide registered designs. Now, until the end of 2020, these give protection in the UK too. But on Brexit, that protection from the EU protection will stop, and all registered EU marks and EU designs will automatically get cloned onto the UK national register. So registrants won't lose any protection, but they will have a mirror registration. If you have an application rather than a registration, that may also be cloned, but you will have to pay the UK IP Office's fees to do that. So the original application will then be processed as two separate applications, one at the UK IPO and one at the EU IPO. And post-Brexit, it's so if you've only got an EU trademark attorney to appoint UK attorneys to look after the cloned UK part of the portfolio. And it will be important to remember that you now have two marks and designs to renew, not one. So your diary management system may also need to be updated. The good news for those of you where we look after your portfolios is that we will be doing that updating automatically. So you don't need to take any specific action. We'll also be able to continue to act on your EU trademarks. So we're continuing to take on a number of portfolios at the moment to support people through that process. So do let me know if you need any help here. But enough about me. It's an exciting time for immigration in the UK, isn't it, Hugh?
Well, it is. We've got massive changes coming very imminently because, of course, from the 1st of January, freedom of movement for European nationals comes to an end. And so we're entering a new world where EEA nationals coming to the UK are going to need immigration permission. They're going to be treated in exactly the same way as people from outside Europe are currently. So we're going to have one unified immigration system for all non-UK nationals.
Okay, so let's start with the position of EEA nationals who are currently living and working in the UK, because I think for employers, the position with this group is relatively straightforward. Can you explain that, Hugh?
Yeah, it is relatively straightforward because EEA nationals and their family members who are in the UK by 11 p.m. on the 31st of December this year, so New Year's Eve, they can remain in the UK after the 1st of January 2021 if, and this is the big if they register under the government's EU settlement scheme by the 30th of January 2021. They have to take that step to obtain so-called pre-settled status or settled status. If an EEA national has been here for 5 years by the end of this year, or when they register, they will get settled status. They can remain here indefinitely, work in the UK without restriction. If they haven't got 5 years, they'll get so-called pre-settled status, which they can flip over into settled status once they get to the 5 year period. It's a pretty straightforward process. It's free. You can do it over a smartphone, but people do need to register. I think that's the key message.
And is the position different for Irish nationals?
Yeah, it is, because their right to live and work in the UK stemmed from the Common Travel Agreement, which predated our entry into Europe. So that position remains unaffected. Irish nationals can continue to live, work and study in the UK without immigration permission and vice versa. So UK nationals can go to Ireland and do the same thing.
Thank you, Hugh. That's helpful. But what's the position for employers who want to employ EEA nationals after the 1st of January? You mentioned the new immigration.
Yeah, so it's going to be one single immigration system. And for those who know anything about it, the UK immigration system has always been and continues to be complex. There are lots of ways that people can get permission to work in the UK. They could be entrepreneurs, they could be students, they may have Commonwealth ancestry, they may marry a UK national. But I think the most common route for businesses is going to be the skilled worker route, which many people may have read about.
I mean, there are many businesses who don't currently sponsor overseas workers. Do they need to become a sponsor?
Yes, I mean, our advice to clients is that if you're relying on EEA nationals at the moment, you should think very seriously about getting a sponsor's license. A sponsor's license is effectively permission from the government to sponsor migrant workers in your business. And if you don't have one, it is going to be very difficult to employ European nationals unless they've got pre-settled or settled status. Now, obtaining a sponsor's license is not difficult in the sense that it comprises supplying documents to the Home Office, but it can take 8 weeks or longer to get a license. There's a cost associated with it. There may be delays because of audits and backlogs. And so if businesses are thinking that they're going to rely on European nationals in the future, they should be applying for a sponsor's license.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. So let's imagine I've got my shiny new sponsor's license. What do I need to actually sponsor somebody?
Yeah, as I've said, the most likely route for businesses is going to be the skilled worker route. And for those who know something about the current system, that will replace the tier two general route that we currently have. The skilled worker route essentially says that an employer can sponsor an overseas national, provided that the person has a job offer for a suitably skilled role. Secondly, the role's paid at a prescribed amount. And thirdly, they speak English to a prescribed level. So broadly the same as the tier two general route we've currently got. But there have been some welcome changes to the skilled worker route. Firstly, the skill level has been decreased. At the moment under tier two general, the role has to be at degree level or higher. Under the skilled worker route, that reduces to RQF level three, which is equivalent to A level. So that's going to open up a lot more roles under this scheme. Secondly, the salary threshold is going to come down. It's going to sit in most cases at 25,600, or if there's a higher rate for the job that they're being offered, that higher rate. It can be reduced in some circumstances to 20,500 or thereabouts, but really businesses should be thinking that people will need to be paid at around the 25,500 mark to be getting into this scheme. And finally, the resident labour market test was the obligation on employers to advertise for roles for 28 days to demonstrate that there were no people in the UK or Europe who could do a role. That advertising requirement caused a lot of headache in terms of prompt recruitment for businesses. That has now gone, and that should reduce delays in the recruitment process.
Okay, so the salary threshold has gone down, but it is still 25,600. And what does that mean for employers who need to employ lower skilled workers who don't meet that threshold?
Yeah, I mean, that is the big question. And the simple answer is that there is no route to bring low skilled or low paid workers into the UK. And the government have made it clear that they don't intend to open up such a route. The message to business is that you need to look at current EU nationals who've got pre-settled or settled status, the local workforce, be that UK or Irish nationals, students who can work certain hours, or look at ways of running the business that rely less on personnel. I think that's going to be a big challenge for many on this webinar.
Any final tips, Hugh?
As always, I've always got some final tips. I think five things probably to bear in mind. First one is, if you have European nationals in your workforce already, remind them that they have to register under the scheme by the 30th of June next year to protect their immigration status. Coupled with that, you're going to need to make sure you've got properly compliant right to work checks for all new recruits into the business to ensure they've got immigration permission. Thirdly, you're going to have to think about your recruitment and workforce planning, because it is going to be more costly. It is going to take additional time and resource within the business. As I've said, you need to think about applying for a sponsor's license if you haven't already got one. And my final tip is, this is going to take more time and resource. As a sponsor, you are under an obligation to comply with the government's requirements, and therefore you're going to need to train and allocate internal resources and staff to ensure you meet those obligations.
Thank you, Hugh. I think it's probably back to Rachel.
Thank you, Helen and Hugh, for those reflections and practical advice. We hope you've enjoyed this webinar. If you would like to follow up with any of the speakers on topics relevant to your business, please do get in touch. You can also find more information plus contact details of all lead lawyers relating to topics connected with leaving the EU on the Brexit Hub on our main website. Stay safe, and we wish everyone well. Thank you.